Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Monday, October 16th, 2023. Thank you so much for tuning in and for watching WVW-TV. We really appreciate your viewership and your sponsorship and your kind donations to the foundation that keeps WVW-TV on the air. We are certainly been broadcasting since 2006, and we bring to the marketplace of ideas a great fresh viewpoint on many of the very complex issues facing society and the economy today. So we're happy to be able to bring this programming to you, and because there's no paywall or there's no subscription, you can tune in whenever you'd like. You can watch certainly our recorded material and also live programming like this. So thank you for tuning in. As you know, we're not a commercial network. We don't sell advertising. We do rely on the generous donations of viewers like you and also sponsors who help us continue this very important work. So I'd like to thank my sponsor, Swiss America Trading. They're kind enough to be a great supporter of WVW-TV, but also help keep my show on the air. And I'd like to thank them for doing that. And also, if you have any interest at all in tangible precious metals, thinking of adding to your portfolio or perhaps diversifying your investment portfolio to include some precious metals, I strongly encourage you to call Swiss America at 1-800-519-6271 and ask them for some free information. They're happy to mail it out to you at no obligation. Or you can go to their website at swissamerica.com. And if you use the promo code Eastman, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, then they will be happy to send you additional information as well. If you go to the website, you can see the products that they offer, and they primarily sell gold and silver and platinum and precious metal metals that you can actually hold in your hand. That's why they're called tangible, because you can touch them. You, if you have them in your possession, then you own them. And they have a great offering of not only gold and silver coins, but platinum. And they also offer bullion, which is blocks of metal in various sizes, and also numismatic coins, which is coins that are collectible, coin collector coins. And the interesting thing about tangible metals, of course, is that you're converting your Federal Reserve notes into tangible metals with the idea that it will give you added diversity in your holdings as how you hold your wealth. Right now, Swiss America is offering a special, which I think is important, and it's $13.50 each for standing Liberty half dollars. And these are standard bullion minted coins, or silver, almost pure silver, and $13.50 all in for shipping included, which is a great, great benefit. And that offer is limited to 250 coins per person, and it only lasts until their inventory is sold out, and then it's too late. So if you're thinking about adding to your precious metals portfolio, or you're thinking about maybe looking for a gift idea as we enter the gift-giving season, the holiday season, precious metal coins, bullion coins can be a great gift. And trust me, they will not be used and thrown away. They will be tucked into a sock drawer somewhere where they will preserve the buying power of you or the gift recipient for years and years to come. They do tend to last a long time. At some point down the road, they'll become collector coins as well, I'm sure. So anyway, give Swiss America a call, 1-800-519-6271, and ask them for the information, or go to their website, tell them Dan Eastman sent you, and take a look at what they have to offer, and keep that in mind for the holiday season. Take advantage of that silver special. And I'm going to talk about something today that might be relevant to actually diversity. Diversifying into silver. I want to jump into the news quickly, and then we're going to talk about one particular situation that's happening in Argentina, and that'll be very interesting. The news this week, of course, it's a busy week. I will be broadcasting today and tomorrow, and then the rest of the week, there's a great big conference in the Ozarks, WVW-TV, so we will not be doing live broadcasting. On Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, I'll be back next week, and it will be, if you have a chance to tune into WVW-TV and learn more about it, it should be a very great program. You'll have some wonderful national speakers, and it'll be very interesting for the marketplace of ideas, or bringing ideas into the marketplace that are that are helpful at helping you refine your critical thinking skills and start to perceive the reality in the life that we live in. So we do have some economic news this week. We are looking tomorrow for U.S. Retail sales report. And of course, the big question is, are they going up? Are consumers strong, or will they be going down because consumers are, you know, pulling in their spending, and we'll see. It'll be an interesting report. There's also housing data this week. There's lots of housing data. We've got the starts, housing starts and permits. That's always interesting to see how many permits, is it up or down? And then housing starts, you know, how many holes in the ground, up or down? And then of course, existing home sales as well. I mean, how is the existing home sale market doing with our, you know, interest rates approaching 8% and very few people wanting to sell their homes because they're living with nice 2% mortgages. They don't want to have to pay 8% for the next one. So we'll be watching the housing data. And housing has traditionally been a strong driver, if not the strongest driver, in economic analysis. When you look at the American economy, housing has always been right up on top, and then manufacturing, transportation, energy, and of course, healthcare is becoming a big number as well. But we always watch the housing numbers, because construction and real estate, it's such an impact on our employment base. The construction industry, you know, all the subcontractors and all the people who work in construction is a huge army of productive people within the economy, and they tend to make good wages. These are livable wages that are meaningful. So the more construction, the better. And of course, when you think about the tangential effect of real estate transactions, as soon as somebody buys a house, first thing they do is they buy some paint, or they redecorate, they buy furniture, or they basically redecorate the place. And that has a tremendous impact on retail sales at the big box retail stores and the paint stores and, of course, the decorating stores. So housing, a robust housing market is good for the entire economy. And of course, transportation as well. If people are using more and more materials to build, then trucking and railroads, and you know, it's just a real important component, and that's why we watch housing numbers so carefully from the economic perspective, because it's a great bellwether or crystal ball or whatever prognostication device that will allow you to have a better understanding of, is the economy growing or shrinking? And I think that's what we're all wondering right now. Also on Thursday, every Thursday we get the jobless claims. And of course, we might wait with bated breath to see how many people applied for unemployment last week. And there's two components. There's the new claims for unemployment. Those are people who were laid off last week. And, you know, we keep them in our prayers. It's never good to be laid off. And if you have to go, you know, take the walk to the unemployment office to fill out the forms, that's not a pleasant experience. The idea is that the states provide unemployment compensation to help people buy groceries in the barest of minimum. These are not big checks. You file for unemployment, you get a little check. You're not living on that check. And what it's supposed to do is keep you, you know, with some food in your stomach until you can find the next job. So jobless claims are an indication. If we have a sudden explosion in jobless claims, then that shows that people are getting laid off. That's not a good place to be. I did notice that the UAW is expanded its strike again, Kentucky plant, and Ford announces laying off 500 people. I don't want to say in retaliation, but maybe as a result of and a reaction to. So we're still seeing that battle as by the strongest, one of the strongest unions in the United States, still battling for wage increases, wage and benefit increases for the workers. And of course, whatever they settle on, and at some point, we hope before the auto industry of America disappears, that they settle, that other unions and other workers will key on to that number and say, well, you know, the car guys got, you know, X, and then we want that too. So ultimately, it's, you know, there's a lot of turmoil going on because of the current economic situation. So we're watching jobless claims, and then continuing claims is another important number. It's not only the people coming into the system, but how long and how many people every week are staying on unemployment. And what we like to see is a shrinking of that number, which means they're going back to work, finding jobs. And this was a transitional social safety net thing where you bounced in, you know, they send you a little check, you find another job, and you're off back on self-sufficiency. when that number grows, the continuing claims grows, that means that people are having a hard time finding the next job, and that's not a good sign for the economy. Because we also look at job creation numbers, and sometimes those numbers, you know, we saw a couple of weeks ago that there was this huge increase in new jobs, and then we found out there was 800-some thousand jobs, full-time jobs disappeared, and 1.1 million new part-time jobs. So if you've got a full-time job with benefits, you lose your job, and now you're hobbling together two or three part-time jobs with no benefits, and you're on, you know, the Obamacare, or the, you know, this exchange health program, which is crazy expensive, then you're in a world of hurt. So we watch those numbers to look at what is the impact of the economy doing to the average American. That's why those numbers are very important. As a sideline, I did notice that there's one story I just wanted to mention, that luxury goods seem to be in the tank. They're not doing very well right now. And it's an interesting thing, because when you think about, as the economy deteriorates and people start thinking about more basic ideas like food, clothing, and shelter, then suddenly the luxury goods market isn't quite as appealing. And I think you're seeing that with a decline in demand for luxury products is suggesting that even the more well-to-do are facing economic uncertainty, and perhaps instead of a, you know, $50,000 purse, maybe you might want to, you know, pay off some debt, or, you know, buy some silver coins or something, you know. But anyway, we watch that as a luxury goods indicator. I will comment that when you look at luxury goods, they tend to be global in nature, and they are driven very much by the new money crowd, primarily Asian money. And there's always been this cachet to European luxury goods. There's a traditional cachet to Europe as having somehow being the epicenter of luxury, when in fact it's been a war-torn continent for the last 200 years. But anyway, they do make some fancy stuff over there, and I think that's really attractive to foreign buyers. And of course, American luxury tends to be a little bit more technological. I'm not sure we're on the cutting edge of handbags and other luxury goods. But the point is, when you see these luxury numbers declining, keep in mind it's not Americans per se. I mean, there's always some subset of the American culture that simply cannot live without a $25,000 handbag. But for the vast majority of Americans, it's more of a curiosity than anything else. But it's another indicator. Okay, the big thing that I want to talk about today, and this was I've got enough time to do this, is I want to talk about the situation in Argentina. And, you know, you're watching this show this morning thinking, well, I don't live in Argentina. What do I care what's going on in Argentina? Well, I could care less. Well, I understand that. As Americans, we tend to think about what's happening in the United States. And Argentina is, of course, an important country in Latin America. It's in South America, on the south end of the continent down there, of course, and it's a predominant. It's one of the largest. Obviously, Brazil is the largest country in South America, and Argentina is very, very much in second place. But the interesting story, and I want to talk about the news story, the economic component, then I want to talk maybe a little bit about the cultural history and red flags and perhaps warnings to America. Latin America and North America has always been a very complex relationship. And I want to talk about the numbers first, and then we'll dive into the history and maybe the warnings. But the big story today that caught my eye was that the Argentine Central Bank increased the interest rate to 133%. Now, our central bank, the Federal Reserve System, it has been fiddling around with the interest rate, and they took that, you know, 5.25, 5.5, 5.75. And effectively what our Federal Reserve is doing is thinking back to the dual mandate that created the Federal Reserve System in 1913. Congress, when they passed the Federal Reserve Act, they said, you know, there's going to be two things that this central bank is supposed to do. And keep in mind, historically in the United States, from 1776 or 1620, Plymouth Rock, whichever, pick a date, central banking idea was looked at askance because there was the Bank of England, you see, in London, and they kind of controlled the world at the time, and we were a colonial shadow of the British Empire. And as a result of that, the American experience was always very suspicious of centralized banking, because that was the group in European countries that financed wars. And one king would square off another king, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of peasants would die and properties would be burned. I mean, the little guys always paid the burden for the egos of the kings, of the big guys, okay? And the Americans were very cognizant of that. If you remember George Washington's second inaugural address and then his retirement statement, basically warning Americans to stay out of party politics and stay out of foreign entanglements. Boy, if we had only listened to Grandpa George, hey, we wouldn't have political parties. I can talk about that all day. Look what they're doing today in the House of Representatives. And we wouldn't be involved in every last war, whether we started them or engaged in them or financed them, whatever. We would have just been a nice, prosperous nation, you know, without having all this political stuff. But the point is, Americans were very, very sensitive to not having a central bank. And of course, there was the first bank in the United States, and then the Biddle Bank. And, you know, there was these attempts at replicating the crowned heads of Europe and all of that. But it was very, very suspicious. And the populists, the old-fashioned Democrats, the ones, the Andrew Jackson Democrats, not the Democrats of today, which are off the rails on the progressive side. But the people, we the people, didn't like this idea of a central bank. So we didn't have one, okay, up until 1913. Well, the dual mandate, of course, is we want to have full employment. You want to run monetary policy so there's enough money in the system so everybody who wants a job can have a job, and we don't want inflation. So it's full employment, and you want to have low inflation. And the Fed has determined 2%, okay? So they see the numbers come out last summer, a year ago, 9.8% inflation. Like, wow, that's a big number. So what do? They jack up the interest rates to slow the economy, pull the punch bowl back from the party, and everything's supposed to settle down. And traditionally, that's the way the Federal Reserve has worked since 1913 through probably last month or last year, okay? So the point is, we are battling 9% inflation. Now it's down to 3.4%, like I was talking about last week. And the Federal Reserve in November is thinking, man, we may have to, you know, it's 3.7 is overall inflation, 4.1 core. We may have to jack the rates again. So we're going to jack it maybe to 6%. You know, it might go to 5.75, 6%. You know, well, here's the Argentine Central Bank, 133%. What they have in, this is the sixth time they've raised it, and it was 118% the last time, and now it's raging. And effectively, what they have is inflation of 12.7% per month. And that is an astounding amount. It's like 138% in inflation per year. Their inflation in Argentina is bonkers high. And of course, the currency of Argentina, like in many Latin American places, is the peso, the Argentine peso. And what has happened, and this goes back to the culture of Spanish America. And this starts in 1492 when Columbus sailed the ocean blue and he thought he stumbled on India. So he called all the locals Indians when in fact they were Native Americans. This is when this started, 1492, and today's, you know, 2023, okay? So there's a whole thing, a whole cultural thing going on. But to summarize this, because you can't give a lecture on Latin America in 15 minutes, is that the Argentine government, for what it is, has gone massively into international debt. They borrow and spend and tax and spend, and their deficits, and this is just a phenomenal thing, is that when you look at their current deficit as to their gross domestic product, okay, then what you see is, I want to make sure I get the number correct here, it was about 3 It's 2.4% of GDP. Okay, their annual deficit is 2.4% of their gross domestic product, and that has triggered a massive amount of inflation in the Argentine economy. And this goes back a long time. This is not something that just happened last week, but because of their political situation, and this is very convoluted. If you want to spend some time studying Latin America, you can, you know, come back in 10 years and you might have a master's degree. It's complicated because when the Spanish set sail in 1492 and Columbus sailed the ocean blue and they stumbled upon what was America, the interesting thing was Christopher Columbus, of course, was an Italian merchant sailor, and he was hired by the king and queen of Spain. Okay, and when they got to the New World, okay, or at least for them, the undiscovered, it wasn't so new to the people who lived there. You know, they were pretty well into it by then. But for the Europeans, for the Spanish, they stumbled upon this new place, which they thought was India on the other side of the globe, only to find out it wasn't. And at the end of the day, they brought with them their concept of governance, which is, it is largely different than the English experiment with government. And keep in mind, at the time, there were two great powers. There was the British, and of course the Spanish. If you remember the Armada, you know, where the Spanish were going to come up and, you know, they were going to take over England, and the British fleet destroyed the Spanish Armada, and you know, Britain rules the seas and became the greatest maritime and colonial power on earth. But that didn't stop the Spanish from taking over southern, you know, all of the South American continent, and right on up to the Rio Grande, and then, you know, basically even up into the northern parts north of the Rio Grande in the old days. And this was a Spanish-influenced thing. And when they landed, the English had a much different view of governance. And I hope I can do this in the time I have left. But if you go back to 1066, the Battle of Hastings, that's where the Normans invaded, you know, England, and they beat the English, the Anglo-Saxons, and at the Battle of Hastings in 1066, okay, and then the Norman conquest brought this idea of French speaking to the English world. And that's why in the English language, there are so many words that have a French derivative and an English derivative, like dinner would be French and supper would be English, and on it goes. And there was this duality as Norman England emerged in the 1000, and then the, you know, 1066 in there. Within 150 years, it became kind of corrupt, and King John, the grandson of William the Conqueror, got caught up with his nobles, and of course, that was the Magna Carta in 1210. And the Magna Carta we look at is the fundamental bedrock of Anglo and American democratic governance. It basically put a collar around the king, and it gave nobles power, created a House of Parliament. It became a democratized process. So when the English colonized North America, their governance system by that time, from 1200s all the way to the 1600s, the long spread, they had rarefied a governmental process where the people were included in the government. Okay, and that's why we had in the South the House of Burgesses. It was a people's parliament. In the North, in the congregational areas in New England, you were admitted to the church and you had a vote. You were a landholder. You had a vote, you know, one vote per household. And at the end of the day, when the English took over North America, the idea was you move the native populations to the West and you grab all the land. See, when the Spanish showed up, they grabbed it all and they subjugated the Native American populations. And they began to be, you know, Spanish. They spoke Spanish. The Catholic Church moved in. So when you go, you know, I always say south of the Rio Grande, it's sort of like my version of the Mason-Dixon line. But the reality is in Spanish, Western Hemisphere, there is a completely different mindset of government in the south, the Spanish side, versus the English side, which is a very democratic process. And on the southern side, it's a very colonialist model where the individuals were subjugated. And there's three basic phases if you study this. There's the original conquistador phase, and then there's the Habsburg phase where they brought in the bureaucracy, and then there became the revolutionary phase, which is basically what we're living in today. So when you get into these countries where there's a government that is, it looks democratic because there's some sort of an election thing going on. It creates an illusion of participation by the public or the populace. But the reality is the big interests, and they're no longer royalists, maybe who knows, but at the end of the day, big interests control these governments. And when they in Argentina are forever borrowing and spending and printing and spending, they have basically ruined their economy to the point where the average Argentinian, they're smart. I mean, you've been doing this for decades. When you get your pesos, the first thing you do is convert it into US dollars because the dollar preserves the buying power, or they buy silver, or they buy gold. What you don't want to hold is a peso that's declining in value by 133%. That's not a good thing to do. So the people, to some extent, know how to dodge that bullet. But what's happened is the poverty rate in Argentina, and Argentina is not unlike the United States. There's vast immigrant from European immigrants. You know, there's all sorts of people that come in from, you know, Italy and the Germans. You know, that's where Adolf Hitler was supposed to snuck off. I don't know if that's true or not. But the point is, Argentina is a very cosmopolitan place. These are, you know, this is not just the natives. This is very European influenced as well. And as a result of that, 40% of the people in Argentina live below the poverty line. And that's a stunning number. In the United States, the poverty line, if one person living alone, if you make less than $14,500 a year, you're below the poverty line. That's not a lot of money. Okay, if you're a family of four in the United States, it's $30,000 a year or below, you're living in poverty. Well, we've got about, right now, about 5 to 8% of Americans live in poverty, below the poverty line. So even if you're low-income American, you're not below the poverty line. So 5 to 8%, maybe I'll say 10% below the poverty line. In Argentina, it's 40% below the poverty line, okay? So it's a real problem. And the big problem with disinflation is it's turning more and more middle class. Remember my three silos, you know, the poor people, the middle class people, the rich people? Well, it's turning the vast majority of the middle class into the poverty class, just like what happened in Venezuela, same problem. And as a result of that, they have an absolute mess. And of course, they have an election coming up on October 22nd, which is like, you know, next weekend. And because of their political factions and their long-term history of dabbling with, you know, socialism and maybe capitalism and fascism, and they get this kind of a populistic blend where when they run for election, it's only to spend more, borrow more, because you got 40% of the people who apparently vote who are living below the poverty line. They're not going to vote for a free market economy because it's not going to help them one bit when you're that far off the rails. Well, I guess I'll get to the punchline here with this idea that the deficit spending is 2.4% of GDP. Remember that, okay? Gross domestic product, your annual income, 2.4% is deficit spending. Would you care to guess what the deficit spending is in the United States? 5.4% of GDP. That's double. Now, when you look at what's going on in Washington, when you can't even imagine, you know, Republicans gain the majority, they elect a speaker, and then they try to do what they can to govern. We can't even do that. Look at the mess we have with the speaker today. We're probably going to end up with some kind of a compromise with the Democrat speakers coming because the Republicans just simply can't pick a speaker. This is the kind of political crazy that you see all over Latin America because it's factionalized. It's driven by big money and big power and big special interests to the point where nobody can govern those places, but all they keep doing is borrow and spend and print and spend and borrow and spend and print and spend. And what they've done is managed to create 133% inflation. how as American government deteriorates from what used to be a logical democratic process to administer the public good and deteriorates into factional crazy where they can't even govern. How do we not escape the same fate as Argentina and Venezuela and these other places that are just economic disasters? And then ask yourself this question. What are you going to do to protect yourself when we're looking at 133% inflation? You might want to give Swiss America a call and take advantage of that $13.50 offer. Because if you don't do something, we can't escape from our currency to the American dollar. They can't, because our dollar is stronger than the peso today. There's no escape for us. We're it. The buck stops here. So keep that in mind, because this is a really big deal. I'll be talking more about this tomorrow, but you have yourself a great weekend or a great afternoon. And thank you so much for tuning in. Bye.